everybody. That's it. Well, thanks for braving the heat, the lack of parking, and Labor Day weekend to be here. It's great to see y'all. How many people do we have for the first time? Yeah, because I'm seeing lots of new faces. This is wonderful. Well, Jeff told you kind of cryptically what we're about, but what we're really about at The Effect is The Effect. We are looking to live the effect of God's love, kind of what we were just talking about a few moments ago. And living the effect of it means a transformed life, a life that is truly changed by what we believe and what we know about God's nature, what we know about the nature of our relationship with Him. In order to get there, there are some roadblocks that often need to be removed. And some of those obstacles are greater in some than others. Some of us who have grown up Catholic, some of us who have studied intensely in an evangelical setting, sometimes have lots of misconceptions about our relationship, our religion, and all of these things that go into blocking just a clear shot at who God is, what this love relationship is all about, and how it can actually change us. The example that I gave during communion is one of those. You know, how an unavoidable, unasked for tragedy in a person's life can absolutely block access to the Father. Because it calls into question all the trust issues, doesn't it? How do you trust a God who allows things like this to happen in our lives? And this is critical. Jeff talked about the Lord's Prayer. One of the things that I have found in my studies is that being able to go back to the original context of Jesus' words in the original language, and he spoke either Hebrew or Aramaic most likely, those languages give us the most solid clues to what he was trying to tell us. And they open up and erase the conflicts that there seems to be sometimes as we read scripture, or seems to be sometimes in the practice of our religion. This is what we're about, and this is what I want to continue doing starting today. I think I mentioned that Jesus' teaching is kind of like those nesting dolls. Have you seen those? The Russian ones are called matryoshkas, which is the word for mother. But there's a big doll, and then it opens up, and there's a smaller doll, and it opens, and it opens, and it opens, so you get this little pea-sized thing. We've got a few at home, and our almost three-year-old loves them, so the pieces are all over the place. It's hopeless now. But that's kind of what's happening in the Gospels themselves. When we looked at the Lord's Prayer, as properly understood, and please get one of those sheets, because we kind of paraphrased it within the meaning of the original Aramaic, is a summary and a dense condensation of all of Jesus' teaching. It's kind of like all there. You know when he said all you need to do is love God and love each other as you love yourself? That encompasses all of the law and the prophets. Well, a little bit more of an expansion of that is contained in the Lord's Prayer. But the Lord's Prayer itself is nested inside the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And the Sermon on the Mount itself is a larger, densely concentrated, and beautifully constructed summary of all of Jesus' teaching once again, which is then nested inside the Gospel of Matthew, which is then nested inside the Gospels as a whole, which is then nested inside the New Testament. And so there's these concentric rings that move outward. But if you really want to understand the whole thrust of Scripture, we're going to start with the smallest pieces. And we started with the Lord's Prayer. That took us 6 weeks to get through. Now, the Sermon on the Mount is a long-term process, and we're just going to kind of take it as we go, and we'll probably take little digressions and diversions here and there. But every facet of life is going to be addressed in the Lord's Prayer, in the Sermon on the Mount. It's amazing the breadth and the scope of what the Sermon on the Mount covers. In fact, scholars now believe that the Sermon on the Mount was probably an early catechism, just in and of itself. And some of you may think of Gospels as being written the way a novel is written, okay, that someone sat down and wrote it start to finish. In reality, Luke gives us a clue to the way the Gospels were really put together. They weren't so much written the way a novel writer would write a novel. They were written more the way a TV producer would produce a TV program, kind of as an editor would, going out and finding all of the eyewitnesses, all of the records and clips and stories to compile to get an idea of what the whole story was about, and then bringing all those bits and pieces together, bringing the film clips together, bringing the records together, bringing the witnesses together, and putting together a fully produced peace. And Luke tells us that's exactly what he did. And that's what the Gospels are. And so we know that there were earlier records, there were sayings Gospels that just had the sayings of Jesus with no narrative content that were out there, probably written in their original language of Hebrew or Aramaic. And the Gospel writer pulled all this together. It's unlikely that Jesus delivered the Sermon on the Mount as is, all in one place. The Gospel of Luke has the same teachings scattered throughout the Gospel. And so Matthew either took this material and created this dense condensation in three chapters, 5, 6, and 7, or he lifted it whole cloth from an earlier document, and we'll never know the truth there. But what we do know is that there is a wonderful order, symmetry, and design to the Sermon on the Mount that I want to try to present to you today. The Sermon on the Mount presents immense challenges. In 2,000 years, you know, the church has had a really hard time dealing with the Sermon on the Mount. And for good reason. They don't know what to do with the language. I want you to just listen to a couple of sayings from the Sermon on the Mount and see if you can get a sense of the problem that we're having here. Jesus says at 5:21, "You have heard the ancients were told, 'You shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court.' But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be guilty before the court. And anyone who says to his brother, 'You good for nothing,' shall be guilty before the Supreme Court. And whoever says, 'You fool,' shall be guilty enough to go into the fiery hell." Well, what do you do with a saying like that? I mean, on the face of it, Jesus is saying that physical murder has the same punishment as just being angry with your brother. And even implies that when you escalate that anger, even before you get to physical violence, you're even more guilty. How do you deal with a saying like that? And then in the 27th verse, he says, "You have heard it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery in his heart." Now, this one I have heard taken literally over and over again. I heard a preacher on the radio say, "Men should never watch TV, because if they do, they're going to break this commandment right here. They're going to lust after the women that they see." But is physical adultery and just looking lustfully at a woman really the same crime and liable to the same punishment? 5:29, "If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you, for it is better to lose the one of your parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you." Now, we don't take that one literally, do we? Otherwise, we'd all be walking around like pirates. Arg. Isn't it interesting? We take that one, the first one in verse 27, literally. Verse 29, we don't take literally. And then in verse 31, it was said, "Whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that everyone who divorces his wife, except for the reason of unchastity, makes her commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery." And I know that one's been taken literally. And the poor divorced among us have suffered terribly under this kind of rule taken literally. But sandwiched in between is the tear out your eye and cut off your hand that we don't take literally. See how difficult this is to try to deal with Jesus' language here. At verse 38, "You have heard it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evil person." Huh? What do we do with that? "But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let him have your coat also." Oh, yeah? Wouldn't that turn the courts into a tizzy? You know? And what about going to war? What about, are we all supposed to be pacifist? Is pacifism what Jesus is actually saying here? Sure sounds like it, huh? "And whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you." Oh my gosh. How many times have you refused to give money to someone when they asked you? And knew that it was the right thing to do, right? You don't want to become an enabler, codependent. Codependents are us, all that sort of thing. But what is Jesus saying here? It seems to flow in the face of common sense, and it seems to be creating an absolutely impossible standard that nobody can adhere to. And that is the problem that the church has had with the Sermon on the Mount. It contains this kind of language. What do we do with it? There have been all sorts of theories to try to rationalize it away, think it away, wish it into the cornfield, I guess, something like that. And some have thought, okay, Jesus is setting an impossible standard so that we know that we can't keep it, and we're going to be broken upon the law, and that will drive us into the arms of God. It's like, okay, sounds a little masochistic, but all right, let's put that one there. Another is that it's some sort of interim ethic, you know, that existed between this dispensation and that dispensation, or it was just a description of late Judaism's ethical rules for itself. All of these things are out there, and all of them really fall short and are unconvincing and unsatisfying when it really comes down to it. When Jesus speaks to us, it should be much more straightforward and complete and understandable than having to go through all these gyrations. And it is. Believe me, everything that I read you just now, if we get back to the original context and language, all of the apparent conflicts just dissolve and melt away. And it's just so simple. And you just slap your forehead and you say, well, of course, makes perfect sense. But we have to try to get there first in order to be able to see what it is that Jesus is talking about. And ultimately, the reason the church and we have so much trouble with this kind of language is because we're always looking at it from a legal perspective. Our whole society is based on a legal perspective. We are the children of Greek philosophy and Roman law. Like it or not, that's who we are. And that's what our church is, too. So we're always going to look at it as that legal contract of sorts. And as a contract, as any sort of legalistic form, it makes no sense whatsoever. But what we find out is that Jesus is not talking about anything legal whatsoever. He's talking about something relational. He's talking about a way in which we live that relationships are made perfect. Relationships are made whole. And he's trying to draw the distinction between anything that has to do with law and this way of living in perfect love. The two have nothing to do with each other except for one thing. And Jesus told us, he didn't come to abolish the law, he came to fulfill it. If you live in this relationship of love, if you live basically in kingdom, if you live like this, you automatically fulfill and keep the law. But if you just try to keep the law, there is not necessarily any connection to getting over here. You're just following a code. You're just doing what is expected of you so as you not to get punished. See the difference? Go here first, he's saying. This is what he's trying to get across. Let's step back a little bit and take a bird's eye view of the sermon really quickly before we get into the first verse that we're going to look at today. And I gave you a handout, so if you want to take a look at that, hopefully it'll give you sort of a roadmap to understanding what it is that is going on here. And it's really an amazing type of format that Matthew has laid out for us. Have you ever heard the phrase, tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them? Ever heard that one before? Basically, if you are putting together a speech or you're putting together some sort of presentation, if you want to get maximum retention in your audience, you tell them what you're going to tell them, you tell them, and then you tell them what you told them. You recap at the end. And in a sense, that's what Jesus is doing here. That's what Matthew is doing here. Also, have you ever read a textbook that right at the beginning of each chapter said, at the end of this chapter, you will be able to, dot, dot, dot. And then list a whole list of things that you're going to be able to do. Again, this is what's going on here. In this first section, in the introduction, what Jesus is doing is laying out, drawing a picture of what the finished product is going to look like. Someone who is actually living in kingdom is going to look like this, look like the Beatitudes, look like the salt and light imagery. If you're not familiar with the Sermon on the Mount, I urge you to read Matthew 5, 6, and 7 just to get familiar with it. But you will as we go through. But in that introductory section, Jesus is giving us this picture of the finished product. When you finish all of these teachings, when you learn to follow all these teachings, this is what you'll look like. You will look like salt and light to the earth. You will look like the city on the hill. You will look like each one of the descriptions in the Beatitudes. He's giving us a picture. Then he moves into his mission statement in verse 17. And he tells us, he's not abolishing the law, he's fulfilling the law. And he tells us, unless you exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, which was a legalistic code, you will never enter the kingdom. That's the topic sentence of the entire sermon. If you want to look at it even more radically, it's the topic sentence of the entire set of the Gospels. Everything Jesus talks about and everything he teaches about will be within the context of his idea of kingdom. That's why it's so important to know what kingdom is. None of this stuff is going to make sense if we think kingdom is heaven. Only if we understand that kingdom is the quality of life we can have right here and right now in the presence of God. And then he goes into a redefinition of the law. And all of those crazy lines that I just read you were from this section where he is redefining the law. The law doesn't mean what you think it means. It means something else. And then he goes into a redefinition of righteousness, because the scribes and the Pharisees had developed their own code of righteousness that they called the oral tradition. They lived by it and they required everyone else to. He redefines that. And then finally, he goes into a whole kind of description of the kingdom principles themselves. What does it mean to live in kingdom? What does it mean to live like that? How do you discern the difference between mere Pharisaical righteousness, mere legalistic righteousness, and true kingdom principles? How do you see the difference? That's where he starts using the difference between the stone and the loaves and the fish and the snake and the egg and the scorpion and all these different symbols and imagery. And then there's the wolf and the sheep's clothing and the tree that doesn't bear any fruit. All of these things are gathered together under these headings right here. And then he ends up with the house on the rock, that if we can get here, we will have a solid foundation. So just taking a look at this, and if you read through, try to get your bearings here. But really, it's still not going to make too much sense until we really dig in. The whole idea here is that Jesus is giving us this prescription for living life. He's not giving us any impossible commands. The commands only sound impossible because we're looking at them through a legal lens. But once we look at them through a relational lens, we realize we can do this. Jesus wouldn't give us something that we couldn't do. That's just cruel. He was giving something that we can absolutely do. He showed us how to do it. And then he said, you can do these things as I am doing. And you can do greater things than these even. It's not about obedience. We're not looking for mere obedience here. We're looking to go way beyond obedience into a desire to live a certain way. And if you come right down to it, this is the key here. The sermon is not law. We look at each one of those commands I read as some sort of command from Jesus. But the sermon is not law, it's gospel. And what is law? Law is man reaching or approaching God through his own effort, through the vehicle or the medium of the law. Got that? Law is man approaching God through his own effort. But gospel is God approaching man with a free gift. How different is that? And so what happens is that if we will simply accept the gift that is offered, the gift that is free, what results is a changed life, a changed attitude toward life that makes us look like law. And so we come full circle. Instead of trying to reach God through the law, we just let God reach us and accept the gift, and then we look like law. We look like kingdom. We look like that picture that Jesus gives us in the very beginning here. So, with that said, let's take a look at the first beatitude. If you do have books with you, we're in Matthew 5, verse 3, but don't worry about it if you don't. We're going to read it. Jesus is on a mountain, and the people are gathered to him, and he just opens his mouth and starts to preach them, starts to teach them and speak to them. And the first thing that he says is, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. So right off the bat, we have a word that we need to look at, blessed. Now that brings up certain images in our minds, but what does it really mean to the ancients who were listening to Jesus' words? And the word that he would have used in Aramaic is tobe. Tobe. And what that means is happy, fortunate, enriched, whole, balanced, healed, all of these things at the same time. There's no equivalent in the English language for a word like that. Now, for those of you who have been through the previous studies, notice that tobe shares exactly the same roots as the word taba. And taba means good or goodness. But that T and that B, that tav and that bet in the Hebrew alphabet are the shared roots. So when two words have the same roots, we know that they share the same meaning. And taba means good in the sense of being ripe, of being whole, of being complete, being at the right place at the right time, being able to function as it was designed to function. So think of blessed in those terms. Blessed, happy, fortunate, whole, complete, ripe, at the right place at the right time, able to function as you were designed to function, wholly and completely. All of these concepts are wrapped up into that first word. That's why blessed is such a thin way of looking at it. And not only that, we think of blessings as being transferring holiness from God to something else, either an inanimate object or a person. But in the Hebrew concept, blessings never had anything to do with inanimate objects, always to do with people. And blessings were always the result of a right relationship, a right response to God or to each other. So out of that right relationship came the blessings. Out of that right relationship came that wholeness and completeness and ripeness. It's the same idea with shalom or salama in Aramaic. That idea of the greatest possible wholeness and completeness being poured out. That was shalom. All of these ideas are wrapped up in that. So enriched, complete, whole are these people who are poor in spirit. Now, what does that mean? You know, we hear that all the time, poor in spirit, but what does it really mean? In Aramaic, it's meskina ruch. Meskina means poor, ruch means spirit or breath or wind. But really, these two words together form a traditional Aramaic idiom. It's a phrase that they used. And what it really meant was someone who was humble, someone who was dependent, someone who was vulnerable. Someone who had an attitude of poverty, even if they were rich. So regardless of your station in life, you could have these qualities of humility, independence, and vulnerability. Now, I was having a conversation with someone, and I was explaining this, and those adjectives didn't sound too good to her. Is dependence really a good thing? Is vulnerability a good thing? You know, when you've been hurt, when you've lost a son, when your life is spinning out of control, when you can't even provide for yourself, dependence and vulnerability are probably not words that you want to hear. But we have to realize that what Jesus is doing is talking on a spiritual level. There's a softness of heart that's involved here. Even if we are working hard to provide for ourselves and our family so that we can be financially independent, even if we are protecting ourselves from whatever comes our way, there still is an interior softness. There still is a place that is open and willing to be touched. A place that does not take undue pride in the station in life that you feel you have earned, but realize that really, in the scheme of things, what kind of control do we have anyway? I mean, really? The planet moves a nano fraction in its orbit, and we're all toast. I mean, how much control do we really have in a cosmic sort of sense, in a spiritual sense? It's that realization that makes us meskina ruch, that makes us poor in spirit, that keeps us humble, that keeps us open. Jesus had the word that he used, unless you become like children, you will not be able to enter the kingdom. The word he used was talia. Talia means child, but it also means house servant or bond servant. The qualities of a child, absolute dependence and vulnerability, a joy and a wonder at life, mixed with the voluntary submission of the slave, of the bond servant, gives us another picture of being poor in spirit. All of these qualities. Jesus is saying, those type of people are blessed. they are happy and fortunate and whole. So if we were to translate this, maybe we could say something like this. This first section, instead of blessed are the poor in spirit, we can say whole, balanced, healed, ripe are those who are humble or dependent or vulnerable and submitted regardless of their station in life. Okay, that's pretty good. The second part, though, is for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, how do we understand that? At Matthew 19, because this is really an unfortunate translation in a lot of ways. For theirs is the kingdom. It's almost as if these people who can get to this point now get the kingdom. Okay? Kind of a quid pro quo, kind of a legalistic, contractual sort of deal. You do this, you get this. It's an unfortunate translation. It's not incorrect in terms of language, but it doesn't convey the meaning underneath. At Matthew 19, when Jesus says, let the children come to me, children, Talia, for of such is the kingdom. Now, your translation might read, let the children come to me, for the kingdom belongs to such as these. Now, again, there we go into this sort of belonging, this legal sort of arrangement. But if you look at the Aramaic, what does the Aramaic say? Literally, it says, for of those who are like these, Talia, children, poor in spirit, is kingdom. Do you get the difference now? The kingdom of heaven is people who are poor in spirit. It doesn't belong to them. They don't get the kingdom. They are the kingdom. The kingdom is made of people who are poor in spirit, who are Talia, who have learned to be dependent and submitted regardless of their station in life. May not change their outward behavior in terms of how hard they work or the dreams that they want to fulfill in life, but inwardly, they've got this openness and this softness and this dependence. The kingdom is these people. And so if we were to translate the whole saying, try this one. Whole and complete, ripe are those who understand and accept their powerlessness, who are dependent and vulnerable with an attitude of submission, regardless of their station in life, for they are kingdom itself, the image of kingdom's fulfillment. Such as these are the fulfillment of kingdom. They are a picture of what kingdom looks like. Have any of you ever read The Message before? A paraphrase of the New Testament. Actually, I think the whole gospel, the whole Bible is done now. Listen to the way he translates this first beatitude. It's great. He says, you're blessed when you're at the end of your rope. With less of you, there's more of God and his rule. Do you see how that works? When you're at the end of your rope, when you realize that all the things that you've tried to do really don't amount to much, and you are still, in the end of all things, dependent and vulnerable. And if you're open to that which can come in and fill those places of vulnerability and dependence, you are kingdom when you're at the end of your rope. And now what are we starting to sound like? Those of you who are familiar with the 12 steps of AA, the first step is what? We admitted we were powerless over, and they say alcohol, but I'm going to leave a blank line there. We admitted that we were powerless over whatever it is that's driving our lives right now, that our lives had become unmanageable. The first step of AA, the first step of trying to crawl out of an addiction, out of an unmanageable life, out of a miserable place, is to admit that you're powerless over the most fundamental things in life. Jesus said, which of you by worrying can add 1 inch to your height or 1 hour to your life? If you can't do those basic things, what is it you really think that you can do that's meaningful, that really is under your control? And so it turns out that the first step in Jesus' sermon is the same step. Blessed, complete are those who understand that they are powerless, who understand that they are like children, like bondservants, who willingly submit to the power that can come in and fill them. It's the same step. Jesus says at John 8:32 that the truth will make you free. What truth has the power to make you free? It's the truth that begins with the admission and the understanding of your own powerlessness. It all starts there, because without that, there is no attitude that makes any further step possible. There's no way to take step two if you haven't really taken step one. But now we've got a catch, don't we? How do we ever voluntarily give up the power that we think we have? Who gives up power voluntarily? Anybody you know? Once the central government gets a new tax law, does it ever go away? You know, it doesn't work that way. When we gather power to ourselves, we hold on to it and we guard it jealously, because it's something, you know, in the crazy world that we live in, it's something that we think we're holding on to. But we've got to do that. But it doesn't come the way that we think it's going to come. We think that giving up power is just that, just giving it away. We think that surrendering and giving up are synonymous, but they're really not. There's a great story that I always love to tell, and my old pastor told me about when his children were young, and they're all sitting around the dinner table, and one of them, who was the rebel in the group, and her name was Debbie, and she always wanted to stand up at the dinner table. And they always told her, sit down. And she'd stand up and sit down. She'd stand up. And after several rounds of this one night, she finally sat down. And she looked at them surly across the table. And she said, I might be sitting down on the outside, but on the inside, I'm standing up. I love that. We do that all the time, don't we? We say we've given up something only to take it back. You know, armies do this. They give up one field of battle, so only so they can consolidate and fight someplace else. What's bankruptcy court anymore than just a technique, a way of giving up something over here so you can pop back over there? It's like squeezing a balloon, you know, it only pops out someplace else. What we need is not just a giving up, but a full surrender. But again, I ask you, how do we do that? It's a great scene from the movie Matrix. And the hero is in a room full of children. And one of them is bending a spoon with his mind. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? It's a great scene. And the hero is looking at him and with kind of amazement. And he hands a spoon to him. And the boy says to him, don't try to bend the spoon. That's impossible. Only try to see the truth. And he says, well, what's that? He says, there is no spoon. And then he's able to do it. Don't try to give up your powerfulness. Only see the truth. What truth? There is no power. You have no power. You're not giving up anything. All you have to do is see the truth that you haven't got any. Well, that's easier. I can do that. And the truth will make you free. The truth will allow you to take the next step and the next step on the process of becoming whole and balanced and complete and a picture of what kingdom is all about. And the amazing thing is that this happens all without your permission if you will just take the first steps. Another movie that I liked, Gladiator. The hero again is urging on his troops in the opening battle scene of the movie. And he says, if you find yourself riding through sunlit fields, he says, relax. You're in Elysium and you're already dead. It's kind of like that. If you will just take the first steps, if you just start admitting that you don't have control over these things, all of a sudden you realize you're riding through sunlit fields and you're already in kingdom. You're already there. And you didn't even know how it happened, but here it is. You're reacting to things differently. You're making different choices. Your relationships are better. And your life is suddenly manageable. And you don't know how that happened. This is the experience of what it's like. But we need to understand that first truth. If we can become poor in spirit, if we can see that the power is not ours, but exists outside of ourselves and inside of ourselves at the same time as a free gift, that all we have to do is pick up, we're well on our way. Let's pray. Father, it's always interesting to speak in any group because you just never know what's going on in people's lives. And if there's anyone here who is really hurting, if there is anyone here who is dragging around a cross to bear, I pray that some of the things that we've spoken about and some of the concepts we're talking about will crack open a little bit of daylight to see a different way. And for all of us, no matter where we are, that the same would be true. Help us to see that we are children in your sight, beloved children who have the keys to the kingdom just written in our beings, in our hearts, that everything that we need is already there, that you've given it to us since the beginning of time, if we can just pick it up and take the next step. And we thank you for everything that you do for us, Lord, everything that you've given us. And we just pray that we will each day take a step closer and closer to that picture that Jesus is painting of the final product of you and us in kingdom together. And we thank you in the name of Jesus. Amen. All right. Everybody, let's stand. And what we do for you newcomers, we circle up and we're going to say the Lord's Prayer.
While we're doing that, you guys, I want to also add, if anybody's hurting, if you've got something going on in your life that's really disturbing you, and if it's health, if it's finances, if it's anything else, then get with me and Dave after the service and we'll do some prayer with you. We should be doing that on a regular basis, and we've just been forgetting to mention that. And so I want to throw that out to anybody that's hurting in any way. We want to pray with you after the service. Okay. Our Father.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power,
amen.
See you next week.